Fellowship, check yourself, and let's continue on here with this matter of the positive aspect. We are under Roman numeral 1, point H2. On a positive note, we are to focus on the reality that when we separate from that which is incompatible with the righteousness of God, we are separating ourselves to God, which has great benefits. 2 Corinthians 6 there, the verses that follow all the questions that demand a negative answer, which again, in verse 16, separates believers, what has the temple of God with idols, and we are the temple of the living God. Therefore, come out from among them and be ye separate, says the Lord, and do not touch what is unclean, and I will welcome you. The implication is that if you do not do this, he does not welcome you. And many believers feel that just because they're believers, God accepts them no matter what. That is incorrect. He does not. He does not welcome the worldly, cosmic believer who will not apply these principles. And this gets into passages like John 14, where Jesus said, I and my Father will come and make our abode with him. He doesn't do that just with every believer. That's the whole point. That there are blessings that the positive believer gets that the other believer never sees. The negative believer doesn't see, doesn't get. And God is we've got a dirty word in our politically correct society. It's called discrimination. Discrimination is not a dirty word. Discrimination comes from discernment. Discernment's not a dirty word. And discrimination is not. Everybody discriminates. Everybody discriminates. If you don't discriminate, you're not very smart. I mean, seriously, if you go to this grocery store and you're looking at apples and you see a really good-looking apple and you see one with a worm in it, don't you discriminate? I mean, please. Don't you discriminate with fruit? Don't you discriminate with produce? I mean, you can't discriminate with cans of beefaroni because, you know, they are what they are. Or Spam. It is what it is. The spare parts of ham or whatever it is, you know. So the point is, everybody discriminates. And it's been turned into a dirty word like discrimination is a bad thing. No, you have a right to discriminate. In fact, you have a mandate to discriminate. And use good judgment and discernment. And again, this has been turned into something bad. Well, it's not. Now, obviously, there are fallacious ways of discriminating when you discriminate based on arbitrary standards. That, you know, but everybody discriminates. Don't you think the DMV discriminates? If you can't pass an eye test, they're not going to give you a license. That's discrimination against the blind. Oh, well, we don't discriminate against a handicap. We sure do. Of course we do. If you're not this tall, you can't get on the ride. We discriminate all the time. Discrimination goes on all over the place. And yet people act like it never happens. Oh, and that if it does happen, it's horrible. Everybody discriminates. And if you don't discriminate, I mean, when you go to buy a car, you don't discriminate? I mean, do you see that really god-awful lime green chartreuse thing that some people must have that I wouldn't be caught dead in? I discriminate. I discriminate on the paint color of my car, for goodness sake. And so people discriminate all the time. And the discriminating person realizes, hey, you know, there's good, bad, and there's everything in between. And there's best. There's good, better, and best. And of course, in some cases, the enemy of the best is the good. You have to be discriminating enough to want the best. Oh, well, I can settle for what's good. I've heard it taught repeatedly. Oh, well, as a pastor, we just have to be adequate. Sure. Yeah. Shoot for adequate. That's good. I think you should shoot for excellence, frankly. I don't shoot for adequate. I shoot for excellent. I don't shoot for just the minimum. Oh, yeah, well, we can do the minimum, and that's good enough. Well, in my opinion, that's not good enough. Sure, we have to be adequate, but I read the tenor of the epistles to me is telling believers, keep improving, keep growing, strive for excellence. And if that's the case for believers, why wouldn't it be for the pastor? That his teaching ought to get better, not worse. It ought to increase in ability to deal with the issues and all of that. So, again, God discriminates. Well, take it up with him. You don't like discrimination? God's very discriminating. God's not going to let anybody into heaven that didn't believe in Jesus Christ. You talk about discrimination, he's going to send an entire category. In fact, the bulk of the human race will end up in the lake of fire because God discriminates. And that's the way it is. A third of the angels are going to end up in the lake of fire because God discriminates. So turn God into evil because he discriminates. No, discrimination is a good thing. The person that can't discriminate, that begins to just accept anything, is the person that will fall prey to everything. That's just the nature of the beast. So, I will be a father to you, and you will be sons and daughters to me. Well, aren't we already his sons and daughters? He's clearly talking about a situation here that transcends just being a believer. If this were just about just being a believer, we're all believers. We're all going to heaven. Everybody that's believed in Jesus Christ has a home in heaven. What do you want in heaven? Well, I just want the bare minimum. Shoot for that. In fact, to shoot for that, you don't even have to do anything. You can get the bare minimum just by believing. I don't want the bare minimum. I want what's excellent. Exactly. I talked about it repeatedly on this trip. I want God to grease my skids every step of the way. I don't want to walk around looking, oh, here, I need to see a sign that God's for me. If God's for you, you won't have to worry about it. You'll see it. It'll be evident. And you won't have to violate doctrine to do it. And that's another whole point. People will violate doctrine to get what they want. You don't have to. Now, it may take God 10, 15, 20 years to give you what you want, but are you willing to wait and humble yourself under his hand? No, most people are not. Frankly, they are not. But if you do, I can tell you it's worth it. That God will bless you when it comes, and then you'll have a clear conscience. This is another whole thing. People do all kinds of things looking over their shoulder. Just waiting. And I don't want to live like that. I want to live with the knowledge, hey, God's for me. I'm walking in his plan. I can see it in the little things of life. Obviously in the big things too. Well, James also 4, 7, and 8. And again, if these things are all just, you know, any believer gets this, then these verses are nonsensical. Why even have them in here if every believer gets this? Submit yourself, therefore, to God. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. Do you think God does not desire a relationship with his children? And God's children stiff-arm him all the time, and then they wonder why God doesn't bless them. Well, let's see. You don't exercise basic manners, common courtesy. You don't apply doctrine very well. You rationalize your behaviors that are wrong. And you wonder why God does not bless you. Why don't you have what you so desperately want? Because God's not giving it to you. So make sure that if that's the case, that it's because you're being righteous and not because you're blowing things off. And then you wait. You patiently wait. Submit yourself to God. There's a parallel verse in Peter there. 1 Peter 5, actually, where he says, similar idea, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God. Quit exalting your own ego, your own choices, your own ideas about what life is supposed to be. And submit to what God has provided for you. Now, people run off, they do these things, they say, I'll pursue it and get it myself. Good luck. Because no matter what you do, God's going to be there waiting anyway. Ask Jonah. Where are you going to go, Jonah? I'll give God the... And Jonah, literally, what he did was spiritually gave God both fingers and ran off in the opposite direction. And says, I've had it. I'm quitting the ministry. And you're going to leave me alone. You think? He didn't leave him alone. God's not... And see, that's it. People have this idea, well, I can engineer this and get it the way I want it. Don't fall into that trap. That is a danger. So again, we are separating ourselves to God, and that has great benefits. Humble yourselves there. Verse 6, 1 Peter 5, 6, under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you at the proper time. Well, guess what the proper time is? It's not your time. It's God's time. And only he knows the proper time. Some people aren't exalted because they couldn't handle it. Some people aren't blessed because they can't handle what they have already. They're not faithful stewards with what they have. If God blesses you with a job where you make $100 a week and you can't handle that, why would he give you $200 a week? Or $500 or $1,000? And I pick, obviously nobody's working for $100 a week probably. I just pick those figures. But why would he do that? It doesn't make any sense. I mean, if you're a parent and you observe a child and he can't handle X amount of freedom, you don't give him 2X amount of freedom. you recognize you can't handle it. And so you limit the, you know, as a parent, you limit the freedoms and keep the environment. And this is what children need. They need a structured environment. They don't think they do. I mean, as a kid, I never thought I did. But I realize now as an adult and from doctrine, you need a structured environment. And I've learned that most believers grow better in a structured environment. I work better on a short leash. I can tell you that. I'm not even afraid to admit it. And the fact that I can go off and do a bunch of things, yeah, sure, I could. But I'm not going to. I'll just stick with the way we've been doing it. Because this way works. I've seen it work. And the proper time, his proper time, maybe 5 years down the road, 10 years down the road. How many people are going to sit and wait and see what God can do? Or they're going to lunge. And they're going to lunge and they're going to do it their way. And then they're going to call it God's will. I've seen people, I had one believer told me one time, well, I prayed about this and I prayed about it. We were trying to buy a house and I prayed about the loan. And I prayed if God didn't want it, it wouldn't come through. And the loan didn't come through. And so what did they do? Say, thank you, God. It's clear that you shut this down. No, they went out and got a loan somewhere else. That's not humbling yourself under the mighty hand of God. When you're not getting what you want, well, pursue it in some other avenue. No. Absolutely not. That does not work. Well, separation, whether people like it or not, will ultimately be enforced by Jesus Christ on everybody. As witnessed in the judgment of the sheep and goats, the Laodicean church, and finally all men. Matthew 25:32 deals with the separation of believers and unbelievers at the time of the second advent. When the principles and the details of Daniel's 70th week have come to pass, and all the destruction, the earth is essentially a mess. It's been essentially destroyed. You have people that are going to manage to survive this. Believers and unbelievers alike. And this whole passage, 25:32 and following, talks about what's going to do. All the nations will be gathered before him. And he will what? Oh, there's our word again. Separate them from one another. And the sheep are going one way, and the goats are going another. The sheep are headed into the millennial kingdom in their earthly bodies. And the goats are headed into whatever that temporary holding place is down there in Hades. That's where they're going. They don't go to the lake of fire immediately. They go down there to Hades to be tormented. And that's somewhere in the center of the earth. I hear they're going to drill to the center of the earth. I'll bet they don't find Hades. But it's down there. It's clear that it's in the center of the earth right now. So the old thing, you know, as you heard when you were a kid, you know, heaven is up and hell is down. It's not that hell is down. The lake of fire, we don't know where that is. But we do know that when people die, they descend into the center of the earth. And it's divided. Now, there's in one compartment, there's nobody there now. But it was divided between believers and unbelievers. Even there was a separation. There was a what? Great gulf fixed. So that you can't come over here and we can't go over there. Separation is enforced. And it will be enforced in all eternity. So he sends the goats to the left. And this is based on their behavior. Their behavior betrays their volition. So that's what people don't get. Your behavior betrays you. And as a discerning person can figure this out. If they will but pay attention to doctrine and observe. And so their behavior betrays it. It's not that they were nice to people and that's what gets them into heaven. I mean, if one reads this on the surface, you say, well, just because they were nice to people, God lets them in. No. They're believers first. But they betray the fact that they're believers by their applications towards others. And I've watched people, some people apply greatly towards other believers. I've watched other people, they won't lift up a finger to help anybody. They've done very little. You look around in the local church and ask yourself, what have I done for other believers, really, that I can point to in the last 6 months? How have I helped anybody? And this is your primary area of application. If you're not applying here, you're probably not applying in other ways either. Because this is the fundamental arena in which we're set up to apply the environment of the local church. Also, Revelation 3:14. And we're not told exactly how all this plays out. There is still a certain mystery to this in my thinking that I've never quite figured out on how this plays out. What does this exactly mean? Revelation 3:14 and following. Talking to the angel, the pastor, read this, pastor of the church of Laodicea. Angel means messenger. The word angelos In its root meaning means messenger. And it's ludicrous to presume that John is commanded to write letters to angels. That doesn't fit the context here. Who's going to deliver it? We have trouble with the postal service as it is. Try getting a letter delivered to an angel and see how that works out. Oh, by the way, what's their address? Just heaven? Which zip? Heaven's got to be pretty big. So, no, this is not angel. This is a letter to the messenger. This is the pastor of the church of Laodicea. And he's expected to gap this information and communicate it to his local church. That's what the deal is here. I know your deeds, that you are neither cold nor hot. And at some level, guess what? That's on the pastor. I mean, he can't control volition totally. But if you set an environment and a tone in which the norm is expected to be diligent application of doctrine, and then people don't do it, well, that's on them. That's not on the pastor then. If he sets the tone and the reality that doctrine's first, here's what we're all about. This is what life consists of. A man's life does not consist of the abundance of things he possesses. What does a man's life consist of? What is your life really all about? Ask yourself, what is life? What does it mean to be alive? The blessings of life. And I look at the blessings of life and I think, you know, my biggest blessing's my TV. No, I don't. Being facetious. My stereo, my car, my house. None of those things. I mean, I'm glad I have a house and a TV and a car and a stereo. Don't get me wrong. Those are blessings. The biggest blessing in my life is my wife. The local church. Other positive believers. This is what it's all about. And people are willing to settle for so far less than that. Well, I'm not. And this is what life is about. Well, because you are lukewarm and neither cold nor hot, I will vomit you out of my mouth. What does he mean here? I don't know, but I don't want to find out. Pretty clear that he's upset. Pretty clear that that these believers are facing a judgment that they literally make the Lord sick. This is most believers in the last days, sadly. The Laodicean church is the predominant church in this day. And so he tells them, buy gold. I advise you to buy gold from me. And see, here's the problem. People have wealth. They have prosperity. In verse 17, you say, I am rich, I have become wealthy, and I have need of nothing. Well, and in many cases, that defines a lot of believers. Most of us don't have great needs. Some of us have needs. But most of us have what we need. Our needs are met. But this is people who are prosperous. And again, there's nothing wrong with prosperity. It's like a gun. Guns aren't either good or bad. Money's neither good nor bad. The love of money is a bad thing. The love of money is a root of all sorts of evil. But people always say money is the root of all evil. No, it's not. Money is neutral. It depends on how you orient to it. If you handle money properly, money can be a blessing. If you don't learn how to handle money, you'll never be blessed. This is one of the first things kids ought to learn, how to live on a budget. They ought to get an allowance, and they ought to be told you're going to live on this, and this is how, and you spend it on what you want. That's your call. If you spend, here's your monthly allowance, or however you do it. There's no magic formula. But here's your allowance. You go out and spend it on what you want. If you're broke, don't come to me later whining. Now, because as a parent, where are you going to go to whine when you run out of money? Oh, I'm out of money. I don't think your boss will care. Well, why are you out of money? I didn't budget it. Well, this is the first thing children ought to learn. How to live on a budget. How to handle money. Because this is critical to your entire life as an adult. And you can explain the failures of a lot of people just on their inability to handle money properly. And that'll get you into trouble. Well, I'm rich, wealthy, have need of nothing. And you don't recognize that you're wretched, miserable, literally pitiable is the idea here. You're pitiable. I look at you and I pity the fool that I see. The Mr. T doctrine. And you don't know that you're poor and blind and naked. I advise you to buy from me gold refined by fire. This refers to the principles of sound doctrine. Where are they going to buy it from, though? That poses a question. Where are you going to get sound doctrine in the last days? The only place I see you can get it is the Philadelphia church. There have to be churches where sound doctrine is available. And of course, that's the church every believer should pray. I want to be in a Philadelphia church. I want to maximize. I want to get to the Bema seat and hear no condemnation. I want to hear nothing but commendation. And this is the only church out of the bunch. Out of all the seven, the Philadelphia church is the only one that gets no condemnations at all. Never speaks a word against them. Only church out of all of them. And so that's the type of church you shoot for. So he's going to, at some level, what's going to happen to negative believers at the Bema Seat? I don't want to find out. I don't know what he means when he says, I'm going to vomit you out of my mouth. I presume that means some kind of separation. So you get to heaven and you're a believer and yet Jesus will hardly acknowledge you. You're still in heaven. Now that's better than hell. It beats that. But I thought you wanted to be his friend. You know, I want to be a person where he not only acknowledges me, but I have great glory and honor and all those other things. A great reputation. That's what I'm shooting for. So you forego things in this life in order to maximize that eternal niche. That's what we have to do. That's the nature of what doctrine teaches. This is what real disciples do. This is the nature of discipleship. Is looking to the eternal future. And then Revelation 20:15, we finally see the ultimate separation enforced completely and totally and permanently on all men. Revelation 20, verse 15. And if anyone's name was not found written in the book of life, he was thrown into the lake of fire, and he separated from God forever and ever with no hope of redemption. And he'll live all his eternal existence knowing that he's there for his own fault. He could have believed in Christ. Endless regret, endless hatred, endless darkness, endless misery. And people are concerned about the fire. Physical pain is bad. Don't get me wrong. I'm not minimizing physical pain. But the fact is, the soulish and spiritual pain that's going to be on these people will be far worse. It will be far worse. The endless regret that I didn't have to be here. I'm here because of my own negative volition. I wouldn't listen. And so, there you go. Well, too, in the Old Testament, Israel was commanded to stay aloof from their Gentile neighbors as God's priest nation. And God, this is the only priest nation, by the way. If you've heard it taught, this concept of the client nation is goofy. It has no biblical documentation. The only nation that God ever selected out of the nations for a particular purpose was Israel. Leviticus 18:24 through 28. And so the United States is not a special nation under God. I mean, we say it, our one nation under God. Well, we're certainly not one nation under God, that's for sure. Only to the extent that God is massively present in heaven and we're under that, maybe. But not under God literally in the true sense of the word. The United States is not particularly any special nation among any of the other nations. It's been taught that we are because this appeals to the cosmic United States mentality. The pseudo-patriots, as I call them. Who want to say, well, the U.S. is somehow different and special than, say, Egypt or Canada or Mexico or any of the other nations. No, we're no different. Not before God. Israel is the only nation that was ever offered a unique prospect of a relationship with God. And they blew it. So God's not in the basis. He's not going to run around and offer it to other nations. They blew it because they got into a works covenant. Bad choice. The Mosaic covenant was always a works covenant, and it'll never work. Leviticus 18:24. Do not defile yourselves by any of these things. For by all of these, the nation of which I am casting you out should become defiled. Well, what were they doing? Verse 22, you shall not have sex with a man as one has sex with a female. Huh. That sounds like homos to me. It is what? An abomination. And it still is. It hasn't changed. While situation ethics may have changed, God doesn't change. God's immutable. If he said this once, he means it. This is a moral issue. Do not defile yourselves. You shall not have intercourse with any animal. You have to tell people this? Well, this is what these pagan nations, the Amorites, the Hivites, the Hittites, the Jebusites, this is what these people were doing. These are the kind of abominations they were engaged in. You look at Sodom and Gomorrah. They were not the exception. They were the rule. And you wonder why God destroyed them, wiped them completely off the planet to where that area does not even exist today. It's probably covered at the shallow south end of the Dead Sea. And why is the Dead Sea so dead? It was salted. The whole area was salted with sulfur and salt. And one woman was literally turned into salt, to give you some idea. Well, he says, don't defile yourselves by any of these things. But by these things, the nations which I am casting out have become defiled. And the land has become defiled. Therefore, I brought its punishment on it. People wonder in the U.S., why are we having these droughts? Some areas are under drought. Some are under flood. Some are destroyed by tornadoes. Some are destroyed by hurricanes. Why these weird weather patterns? This is God jamming a nation. He's warned this under the Mosaic Law that this is the way he operates. And if he operates this way with Israel, what do other nations think they're going to get? Some separate, better treatment? No. He warns you, I'll make your sky bronze above you. That's drought. You got two kinds of tests with water, the too little and the too much. The too much test, I saw some of those, watching cars just washing down the road in Colorado there and in other places. And you got all this going on and people are, why is this happening? This is weird. Well, let's blame it on global warming. Let's not acknowledge that God's jamming our nation. We can't think that. Let's blame it on Mother Nature. Yeah, I see her a lot. I don't see her mentioned in the Bible, but, I hear her talked about a lot like she exists. Yeah, she doesn't exist. For the land has become defiled, therefore I have brought its punishment on it. The land has spewed out its inhabitants. But as for you, you are to keep my statutes and my judgments, and you shall not do any of these abominations. Neither the native nor the alien that sojourns with you, for the men of the land who have done all this, all these abominations, and the land has become defiled. And he tells them, if you engage in similar activity to what I am jamming these people for, I am going to jam you. This is not hard to figure out. God is, if he's nothing else, he's consistent. He's very consistent. Well, he has to be. He's immutable. He can't change. Of course he's consistent. Also, Deuteronomy 7, 1 through 4. So Israel was warned. And if this nation does not serve as a warning to everyone, to every nation, then they don't understand God. And of course, that's the big problem. People don't understand God. They don't believe he means business. They think he's going to relent on this, that he's changed his mind. He doesn't change his mind. And when the Lord your God brings you into the land you are entering, and it clears away many nations before you, the Hittites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, the Jebusites, seven nations greater and stronger than you. And when your Lord delivers them before you and you defeat them, you will utterly destroy them. You will make no covenant with them. No agreements, no treaties, none of this junk. And what's America relied on for the last 100 years? Treaties. Treaties with our enemies. Go to the American Indian and ask him how treaties work out. Well, we got the casinos. You traded a nation for casinos. Why did God do this to these people? I'll leave it up to you, but they were pagan idol worshippers as well. You look at their indigenous nation, these indigenous peoples and their religion. They worship the Great Spirit. They prayed for rain and all these other things and prayed to the elements and the earth. And Mother Earth is a huge part of many of these things. Gaia, as it's now referred to. Because they personify the earth as a woman. Well, he says, when you do this, you make no covenant with them and show no favor to them. How have our treaties with the Russians worked out? Well, if you go investigate it historically, you will find out that the Russians have violated every treaty we've made with them. And yet, we continue to do this. And we can't quite understand why the Russians would give safe haven to an American that blew the whistle on what our NSA has been doing. But this goes back further than people want to acknowledge. Again, 1 out of 10 calls was being tapped back in about 81 or 91, somewhere in there. But they've been engaged in this behavior for years. This is just the tip of the iceberg that you're seeing in this stuff. And turning back over to us, I'm sure he'll get a fair trial. No, he won't. We've already demonstrated that we no longer believe in due process. Go to Guantanamo and look around. We don't believe in due process. Our government doesn't believe in due process. Our government believes it's above the law. And nobody's held accountable anymore. And so, make treaties with them. Nope. No covenants. No treaties. Show no favor. You shall not intermarry with them. You shall not give your daughters to their sons, nor shall you take their daughters for your sons. For they will turn your sons away from following me to serve other gods. And what do we see in the life of Solomon when he began to violate this doctrine of separation among these pagan indigenous peoples? Solomon tubed it spiritually. And he began to get involved in the same pagan idol worship. He's a believer, but he gets involved in the same pagan idol worship that these nations did. Well, do you think God blessed the latter days of Solomon's existence? He did not. Solomon was under judgment. Do you think when David pulled his stunt that he was blessed the rest of his life? No, he was under discipline for the rest of his life. We would try to spare you from those sorts of mistakes because the ramifications are long-term. You might commit some errors in judgment you may get by with. They may not do you in immediately. Other errors may follow you for years and years and years, and indeed even for the rest of your life. And that's just the way it is. Why? Because they'll turn your sons away from following me to serve other gods, and then my anger will be kindled against you and destroy you quickly. Does this sound threatening to you? Sounds threatening to me. Sounds very threatening to me. And you can also see 18, 9 through 14. Hey, this doctrine was caught in Codex 2. We divide the Mosaic Law into essentially three separate divisions. Codex 1 is the moral code. These are like the Ten Commandments. Moral issues that are always true. They don't change. Moral issues never change. Morality is morality. Apart from situation ethics and other common New Age stuff that we've embraced now, the reality is if it was wrong once, it's always wrong. Homosexuality was an abomination then. It's an abomination now. Adultery was an abomination then. It's an abomination now. These types of behaviors, you know. And of course, many people today, they would never consider child sacrifice. Well, they might. Give you the right child, you might think about it. But the point is, most normal parents won't. But yet these people that get involved in these cults and various other things, they end up sacrificing their children in many ways. Not physically. They don't go out and throw them into the arms of Molech, the god of fire, and burn them to death like they did. And this is how bad people can get. I mean, who would consider doing this? This betrays a very depraved and debased sort of behavior. Where does this come from? Embracing the Canaanites. Compromising with them. Intermarrying with them. This is what happens. So Codex 1 is the moral code. Codex 2, the ceremonial code. This was a complex part of the law that taught basic doctrines through typology. Doctrines related to Christology, soteriology, salvation. These types of things. Functions, hodology, functions in the Christian way of life. How the priests were to function prefigures how believers are to function. You have the altars that teach certain things. The bronze altar represents the cross. The bronze laver represents rebound. The holy place represents time in which the believer functions. The priests represent believers. So Codex 2, this is the ceremonial code that teaches many, many things. Doctrines about redemption, salvation, the coin of the realm, silver points to redemption. Bronze points to judgment. The colors have symbolism. The numbers have symbolism at a certain point. The very institutions have symbolism. And in typology, if the whole is a type, one is rightly justified in seeking typology in its parts. And we do. And then Codex 3 is the social code. This is like an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, the legal code. And see, people can't justify this because they don't understand that to have a polite, civilized society, you have to have justice. Anytime I hear justice going on, I hear it called vengeance. Justice is not vengeance. Those are two different things. Justice is God's righteousness being exercised. You see, it's right to put murderers to death. It's right to deal with rapists and put them to death. But the Old Testament makes these moral issues very clear. You don't have to guess about them. It's right to make the criminal give restitution. No, we don't put him up in a cell and give him a color TV. And a nice comfy bed. He makes restitution. He goes out and works till he's paid back what he owes. Any quote, money a prisoner ever makes should go immediately back to the victim. But we're not going to do that because we're not a righteous nation anymore. We're not going to enforce these principles. And the social code is designed to make people a polite, honorable society in which people treat each other right. That the neighbor doesn't do another neighbor wrong. The neighbor takes care of their house. The neighbor does not engage in dangerous behaviors that endanger his neighbors. The law manages this and says, hey, you've got to attain to a social code. And as one of those old white guys said, pretty smart, an armed society is a polite society. Because if you fear that somebody's going to blow your brains out, you're probably likely not going to cross them. You'll probably be a good neighbor. I'm not saying everybody should be armed. I don't carry a gun, never have. Not interested in it, frankly. But the fact is, if people think like this, if they recognize that this behavior will be punished, then they're way less likely to do it. Any argument that punishment or capital punishment or any punishment is not a deterrent has never raised a kid. That's the stupidest argument I've ever heard. Let me ask any child, does the threat of punishment scare you? It did me. And I always knew. I mean, because as boys learn as they get older that mommy is the softer touch. And daddy's there to kind of be the backbone of the family. Because mommy can be manipulated and pushed around because she's more emotional. I knew this. I learned this by the time I was 6. I also learned by the time I was 6 when mommy said, wait till your dad gets home. Oops. I also learned that punishment would be meted out. And it was. My parents were not abusive, but I got whipped and whipped regularly. Every child should be, unfortunately, because of the nature of their sins. And they have to learn that there's punishment attached to certain behaviors. You violate trust, you're going to be punished. So don't violate my trust. Let me trust you. I want to trust you. I've never met a parent that thought, well, I just don't want to trust my children. Most parents want to trust them. Well, the social code here, Codex 3, is for that. Well, the doctrine was taught in Codex 2. It indicated that physical association with items that had been declared unclean by the Lord rendered the person ceremonially unclean. Leviticus 5, 2 and 3. And this is physical items. We've already seen that people, associations with certain people, will get you into trouble. Now we're talking about certain items even that you don't contact with. If you came into contact with it, you were rendered unclean. Now you could get clean, but you had to acknowledge that you'd been unclean. You have to deal with it. Tantamount to rebound, of course. Leviticus 5, 2 and 3, if the person touches any unclean thing, the law of the clean and the unclean is designed to teach separation. Whether a carcass of an unclean beast or the carcass of unclean cattle or the carcass of unclean swarming things, though it is hidden from him, and he is unclean, then he will be guilty. These are sins of ignorance, essentially. Do we sin in ignorance sometimes? Sure we do. The more doctrine you know, the harder it is. That takes some of the fun out of it. You can't justify it as easy because you know, well, yeah, that's a sin. I may do it, but I know it's a sin. I can't rationalize it away. I can't say, oh, it's not a sin. But yes, we sin ignorantly sometimes. But are we still guilty? Let's say you don't know what the speed limit is and it's 40 and you get stopped for going 45. Do you think the cop cares if you knew what the speed limit was? Nope. He does not care. And he doesn't have to care. Ignorance is no excuse. And so the same thing is true spiritually. Ignorance is no excuse. So people, but why? Because number one, the Bible's here. We don't have to be ignorant for one thing. It's all here for us. Or whether he touches human uncleanness or whatever sort of uncleanness with which he becomes unclean. And it is hidden from him. Then he comes, and when he comes to know it, he will be guilty. And then it gets into swearing thoughtlessly with his lips and other matters. You're going to figure it out at a certain point. That's the whole point of all of this, is you do figure it out. And then you have to deal with it. And you can also see 11, I don't want to read that whole passage, 4 through 25. Well, B, this was designed to teach the spiritual reality that association with that which is opposed to God and His plan. This defiles the believer spiritually. See, Israel was commanded to separate from the religious practices of the nations around them. We have seen that, that you do not do what they do. You're told not to do this. Two, they are commanded to separate from the opposite sex of these nations. Something that adjusted believers recognized even before the Mosaic Law. Even before this was codified as a law. Adjusted believers had figured this out. That bad associations drag you down. And they figured this out. Genesis 24:3, you see it in the life of Abraham. There's no law about this at this time. But Genesis 24:3, he's talking to his servant. And he said, "I will make you swear by the Lord, the God of heaven and the God of earth, that you will not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites among whom I live. I will not let him marry somebody that's negative." And that was essentially the deal. He knew these pagans and their religious practices, and he understood that association with them could drag his son down. And he did not want this. Good parents don't. Don't want you to marry somebody that's negative. It's a mixed marriage at best. That's the problem. And so Abraham recognized that there's no law against this. This is just good common spiritual sense that Abraham manifests here. Also, Genesis 28:1. Same thing we see also in the life of Isaac. His son figured this out. Enforced the same principle that Abraham enforced. Isaac called Jacob and blessed him and charged him and said to him, "You shall not take a wife from the daughters of Canaan. You do not do this. You've got to intermarry with people that are doctrinally of your kind," we might say. And you can also see Deuteronomy 7, 3 and 4. We have looked at that one just now. D, when they observed these restrictions and separated from the pagan culture around them, they were blessed. When they did not, they fell under the cursing provision of the Mosaic Covenant. Deuteronomy 28, which spells this out, and essentially says, when you obey these things, I will bless you. When you don't obey them, I am going to jam you. And when we, and again, most normal parents enforce this kind of stuff anyway. I don't know that I've ever remembered a parent saying, "You know, when you go to school, try to find the drug dealer. Try to find the loosest girl you can find and hang with her." You teach your children the opposite of this. Try to find the kid that's in the most trouble and be his friend. No, we teach our children discernment. No, don't associate with certain people. Discrimination, see? We teach them this. And yet they still go out and do it. I mean, we can't stop them. They have their own volition. But then to lay hands on it? No, absolutely not. And I've enforced this in my family. And no, it's not always pleasant. And again, I've seen it work out to where, yeah, guess what? You go out and you get somebody that's negative, and it can blow up in your face. And it can, and again, you may be an exception to that rule, but again, very few exceptions that I've seen. I've seen some, but I wouldn't bank my life on it. And I wouldn't suggest that you do either. Deuteronomy 28. When you do all these things, if you diligently obey the Lord, being careful to do all that I've commanded you, the Lord will set you on high above all the nations of the earth, and all these blessings will come upon you and overtake you if you obey the Lord. Blessed will you be in the city. Are our inner cities blessed? Nope. Blessed will you be in the country. Is our agricultural system blessed? Nope. We're either in flood or drought, just depending upon the deal and the year. Blessed will be, you will be in the city and the country, your children, your basket and your kneading bowl. In verse 5, your shopping cart will be blessed. You should pray about it when you shop. God's interested in every detail. God, I want you to bless me. Lead me to the right things. I don't want to pay too much or too little. I want to buy quality. And God understands this and recognizes the value in this. And when you commit these things to Him, He can bless you. The Lord shall cause your enemies who rise up against you to be defeated before you. They will come out against you one way, and they will flee before you seven ways. And if one wants to acknowledge it, the quote, last war the United States won was World War II. And first, there haven't been any wars since then. This is, again, revisionist history. The Korean conflict was not a war. The Vietnam conflict was not a war. We are not at war in Afghanistan. We are not at war in Iraq. We are not at war against terror. How do you have a war against terror? I'm commanding you not to be afraid. Well, how's that working for us? Not too well. A war has to be declared by Congress. I can read the Constitution. I understand it. And while our people, and see, the media is designed to continue to brainwash you with this thinking that, oh, we're at war, we're at war, we're at war. Again, read 1984 if you haven't read it. It's all right there for you. Orwell laid it out. And he was a Fabian socialist. Wasn't even a believer. And saw this stuff coming. And that's ironic. Well, we haven't beat anybody. But again, where should we have even been in some of those places? We're saving the world from communism and saving it for democracy. We're saving it for Nike and Pfizer is who we're saving it for. That's who we're saving it for. The Lord will command the blessings on your barns, and all that you put your hand to, He will bless you. That's where I want to be. I want to be where God blesses my efforts. Verse 15, but it will come about if you do not obey the Lord and do these things. Cursed will you be in the city. Cursed in the country. All these other things. I can jam you in every way I can bless you. I can jam you. Which side of the coin do you want to be on? I want to be on the blessing side myself. So again, when they observed these, they were blessed. When they didn't, they were jammed. Well, ultimately failure to separate from these pagan nations led to their separation from the land of promise. They were finally booted out of it. They finally came under a complete dispersion. They lost their entire land because they would not obey God. Do we see any parallels? Can we learn anything from this? Yeah, we sure can. Leviticus 20, 22 through 24. Now, when they came to Kadesh, the sons of Israel, the whole congregation came to Mount Hor. Oh, whoops, wrong one. Let's try Leviticus. The verse makes a lot more sense if it's found in the right book. Leviticus 20, 22. You are therefore to keep this, so that the land to which I am bringing you to live in will not spew you out. Moreover, you will not follow the customs of the nation which I drive out before you. For they did these things, and therefore I have abhorred them. This is the strongest term for hatred you can come up with. God doesn't say, I just hate it. He says, I abhor it. This is so despicable to me what these people do that I am going to blast them from the land. And guess what? You fall into the same patterns and I will blast you from the land. And this is the same way God still operates. Moreover, you will not follow the customs of the nations, which I will drive them out before you. I have abhorred them, and you are to possess the land, and I will give it to you. I am the Lord your God who has, what? Dirty word, separated you from the other peoples. You're different. You've got to be different. And this is the same thing that is true of believers today. You can also see Deuteronomy 31, 15 through 22, where Moses made a prophecy and said, this is going to come upon you. He told them, I know what you're going to do after I die. You're going to rebel against God. And you're going to rebel against God to the point where He will ultimately take you out of the land. The first actual dispersion occurred in 721 BC under the Assyrians. The 10 northern tribes were taken captive and they were led off into captivity. The second one occurred in 586 BC. There were stages to that one, but the primary date was 586 BC under the Babylonians, when the two southern tribes were taken. And boom, they were out of land. Then they returned 70 years later, according to the prophecy in Jeremiah. And then guess what? They continued to remain under foreign domination until the time of the Romans, when their negative volition and their rejection of the truth reached a zenith. And God said, that's it. No more grace. You're done. And He destroyed them. Millions, thousands, hundreds of thousands of Jews were slaughtered. Just killed on the spot. The temple was razed to the ground and the nation was sent into dispersion, where it remained for almost 2,000 years. Until the timing of the Balfour Declaration, which granted them a homeland, and then it began to be a reality in 1948. And they've been moving back into the land, as according to the prophecy, in unbelief. Ezekiel 37 makes it plain they're going to come back in unbelief. And guess what? Absent a repentance and absent some things happening, they would be booted again. But in this case, they're going to make it. They're not going to lose their land for a third time. Or a fourth time, depending upon how you count it. Okay, well, our time is gone. We will have to stop there. We will continue to move on through this on Tuesday. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for the opportunity to fellowship in the things of your word. May God, the Holy Spirit, enlighten us in Christ's name. Amen.